Good day, friends and listeners. I hope you're having a good day or evening, wherever you may be. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and this is Red Ice Radio. We are glad to have you with us today. RedIceCreations.com is the website. We are speaking with Jeff Gates today. He was the legal counsel for the U.S. State Finance Committee in the 1980s, and he has real insiders understanding and knowledge of the criminal network that controls the United States government and had taken the country to war. He is an author, educator, attorney, investment banker, and advisor to policymakers worldwide. He used to be, as I said, counsel for the U.S. State Finance Committee from 1980 to 1987, specialist in employee benefit law, pensions, 401k plans, stock options, and employee stock ownership plans, ESOPs. He deferred benefit plans account for more than half of the $17 trillion in funds under management in the U.S. ESOPs are in place in 11,500 U.S. firms, covering 10% of the workforce and holding $90 billion in assets. He was a draftman for the 1986 Presidential Task Force report on Project Economic Justice. He had a law practice with former Senator Russell Long, a Democrat of Louisiana, and Paul Lexalt, a Republican of Nevada, who was a chair of Ronald Reagan's presidential campaigns. He was legal counsel to Kelso & Co., Manhattan-based investment bankers, completing $4 billion in transactions from 1988 to 1990, including a $3 billion leverage buyout of American Standard Incorporated, with employees and managers gaining a 33% stake. He's been a contributor to trade, professional, and popular publications worldwide. He has been an insider both in politics and also economics, and he has a lot of knowledge in these areas, but he's also an author. He's written The Ownership Solution Toward a Shared Capitalism for the 21st Century, Democracy at Risk, Rescuing Main Street from Wall Street, and then also the book we'll be speaking about here today, Guilt by Association, How Deception and Self-Deception Took America to War, and this was first published in 2008. So the topic here we have lined up for today is the Israeli lobby in the U.S., and of course all the most important things surrounding this that you need to wrap your head around if you are to understand U.S. foreign policy, finance, and who is pulling the strings, and who is in control. But we have a lot to squeeze in today, and we only have 1 hour with Mr. Gates, so buckle up and we'll get right to it. Hi, Jeff. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming on with us today. It's great to have you on the program.
Great to be here, Henrik. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's going to be interesting. Of course, you've written Guilt by Association. Tell us how you came to write the book, Jeff.
Yes, I had worked in financial policy and politics for quite a long time, both in the U.S. and abroad. And while giving a speech in London, I met a fellow who told me some quite disturbing facts that I thought, frankly, were some kind of conspiracy theory. And to his credit, he challenged me to prove him wrong. And now I'm 12, now in my 13th year of working quite hard to prove him wrong and failing desperately, failing completely. And in the course of that, uncovering a form of systemic criminality that has sort of reshaped my worldview as to what is going on in the background that makes us endorse behavior that's not in our really in our interest, either as a nation or as a people or individually. And so Guilt by Association was meant to capture in the title, in part, how this criminality works, meaning we call it correspondence theory. If I'm associated with someone who is despicable or discreditable or whatnot, I look despicable. And that, in part, is what has happened with our long-term relationship with this Zionist enclave that we recognized in 48, that we now have been discredited by that relationship.
Well, indeed, classic fallacy, really, guilt by association. And it's amazing. Have you noticed that when you mentioned that that a lot of people that actually have set out to look into some of the more, I guess, bigger, what many people call conspiracy theories, once they actually go into a lot of the research and look into things for themselves, they always find a completely different world of material and things that were never brought to their attention. I think we shouldn't be too quick to dismiss. I know you don't like the term conspiracy theory, neither do I, but it's easy for us to dismiss conspiracies as something outlandish, but that's not always the case now, is it?
Well, that's the challenge here, because people have tried to penetrate this phenomenon from the outside looking in. And due to the person I met and his personal experience, who will be identified in the next book, a sequel to Guilt by Association, he really profiled this from the inside. And that is very, very different. It's too long a issue to get into on this particular interview, but that will come to light soon. But when you're trying to look when you're trying to peer through a glass darkly, as the poets might say, it's very difficult to see how this actually operates. When you're simply inside and chronicling the facts of how it operates, then the how becomes very, very transparent. And what we're doing with these books is attempting to give people the tools of perception to see this corruption for themselves and not be induced, because so there are an enormous number of conspiracy theories out there, and they are just that, theories. And some people get close to it and have certain aspects of it, but I've yet to find someone that did not sort of spin off into outer space and get themselves branded with a point of view that they then tried to defend, which could not be defended because it was a theory and it wasn't based in fact. And that's why the book that you've seen has, I think, 110 pages of endnotes and only about 180 pages of text. It was meant to say, look, this is not some theory. Here's how it works. I don't care whether you believe it or not. Here's how it works.
Yeah. Period. Very good. So the series of the books here is called The Criminal State, and this is the first volume in this series, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, very good. Now, let's just kind of get right into it here then and talk a little bit more about the criminal network that ended up controlling the U.S. government, that obviously took America to war, etc. How would you explain this to someone who either disbelieves this or completely, you know, new on this particular topic, Jeff?
Well, some people call this Zionism. I was not comfortable with that term, and I still do not know quite what it means. I put it into the book at the very last moment. Trained as a lawyer, I just think of it as organized crime, very sophisticated and transgenerational. The question was, how does something sustain itself over a very long period of time? Conspiracies do not hold together. A conspirator dies, one of the conspirators sells their story to a newspaper, that sort of thing. It's like a cartel. They're notorious for not holding together well. But this thing has got robustness and longevity like nothing anyone has seen. And so what we in part open that book by explaining how the politics of it work through explaining the simple math of campaign finance. And how, if you're sort of an extremist, sort of elitist a group of people who truly believe that they're not subject to the rule of law and have the right to sort of operate above and beyond the rule of law, how by focusing your attention on screening candidates and putting candidates into office and then grooming them to rise in seniority in the Congress, you can, over a period of years, and it's been, since 1948, it's been only a few decades, you can now exert quite extraordinary influence inside the U.S. government. I don't know if control is quite the word, but it's very close to that at this point. And so it's very disturbing because it's a set of values that are very contrary to the values that we think we are governed by. And to even brush up against this at all, and identify the common source, the great smokescreen is that you're and we predicted this in the book, is you'll be charged as, and this came from Noam Chomsky, whose analysis I think is 180 degrees off the mark, but he said it doesn't matter what the facts are, these are the original commissars. And I didn't realize he meant that literally, the original commissars, and it is literally the original commissars. He says the facts are irrelevant. You will be described as an anti-Semite, a Holocaust denier, and a Jew hater.
Sure, yeah.
And that's so unfortunate because the greatest victims of this are the broader Jewish population whose identity as Jews has been manipulated by this very small group, many of whom just happen to have that same ethnicity, but are not, do not adhere to anything to do with the Jewish values or Judaism at all. They're largely agnostic or atheist. So it's a very complex thing to sort of sort out and say, okay, what is that? What are you going to call it? And perhaps one of your viewers will have a phrase we can coin, but I'm not happy with any of them I've seen so far.
All right. Now, I don't know if this is jumping ahead of ourselves here, but let's just talk a moment for what this is about then, in terms of the core allegiance, what this criminal network is actually aiming towards, because obviously we do have Israel as a major player in all of this, and if that is the central core, that perhaps would explain why this could carry through multiple generations, for example, through time. It would be something which would be, I guess, partially religious in origin. I don't know if you would agree with that.
Well, it's again, the Israel itself, including the moderate and members of citizens of Israel, have also been victimized by this. And I include an account in the book from a friend of mine who was a speechwriter for Lyndon Johnson and used to write his speeches on Vietnam. And he told the old man, as he called him, he said, I should go over there and look around if I'm writing your speeches. And I'd like to come back through Israel on the way back home. And he said, fine, just clear it with everyone. And he happened to fly back. His name's Harry McPherson, who's still alive, a lawyer in Washington. And he flew back through Tel Aviv and flew in just in the airport, lights were off. And he thought that was curious. He got a call the next morning at about 4 a.m. from our ambassador. And he said, the war has started. And he said, what do you mean the war? This is the 67 war. And he said, I just came from the war. He said, I'm going to pick you up. They immediately went to see Abba Ibn, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, the ambassador, and then went to see the head of Israeli intelligence. And they said, well, what is it that, did the Egyptians come across the border? And the guy changed the subject. And he said, and they asked again, he changed the subject again. And about that time, they heard these air raid sirens beginning to wail, and they said, don't you think we should go into the air raid shelter? And this head of Israeli intelligence looked at his watch, and he said, that won't be necessary. And these two gentlemen looked at each other, Harry and the ambassador, and they said, oh, my God. This was a put-up job. They had been setting up this attack on Egypt, and took out their air force, the entire air force, in about an hour and a half. There was no attack on Israel. And I tell you that story because it was meant to inject fear and insecurity into the broader Israeli population itself. And yeah. So you had this sort of the far right in Israel, which has run the country since its inception. Even when Rabin came in, they allowed a Likud member to come up behind him and assassinate him. And then they went to Russia and brought in all these right-wingers out of Russia to boost the Likud sort of, electoral ranks. And so this is kind of an ultra-right-wing sort of group that sort of coalesces around a shared faith tradition that they don't really observe, and a very good salesman in persuading you that they are victims and that indeed we should be aligned with them to our great disadvantage and to their great joy that we continue to fall for the notion that it's to our advantage to do so.
Yeah, well, the play on victimhood here is very important. Maybe we can return to that question a little bit later. But I return to the motive of expansion of Israel and the idea that they want to try to, obviously weaken the other states around Israel in the Middle East, etc. Because this, what you write about in the book, is a lot about how they managed to drag America into this war with the aid of the neocons and everything else that on faulty evidence really tried to pin something like 9/11 on Iraq, which was completely wrong, of course, but they managed to pull it off nonetheless, right?
Well, yeah, in order to do that, and you needed to dominate what a former defense secretary named Robert Gates, I think, aptly named he called them the people in between, which is a very generic, non-ethnic sort of term. And he said, when you're waging unconventional warfare, and it's only unconventional to those on whom the war is being waged, and that war is being waged against the American public, as one of their great victims in this, what you do is you put your operatives in that in-between space. If you have a democracy, or what little remains of it, and you want to have a system of governance based on facts and the rule of law, then it's essential that you have access to the facts in order to have informed consent, in order to know who to vote for, what to embrace, that sort of thing. And so what this group did, the syndicate, is they focused enormous amount of attention on dominating media, which is a huge in-between domain. If you turn on CNN and you get Wolf Blitzer, 17 years with the Jerusalem Post, when he's talking about anything other than the Middle East, you get pretty straight news. If you go anywhere near that, you're not getting straight news. I'm sorry, you're just not. And you see that now with the ongoing, with what's happened in the post sort of Paris environment. But if you focus on advancing a narrative through dominance in media, in pop culture, in politics, in think tanks, in education, those five key domains, then you can induce people to embrace a narrative that they themselves can't really see that they're embracing, because it's the screen, the sort of frame through which they now perceive their world. So you noticed how we segued seamlessly from a Cold War fighting a people who hate our values into a war on terrorism fighting against people who hate our values. Yeah. And yet the values that are being undermined are the very values on which the country was founded, and they're in serious jeopardy right now.
Yeah, for sure. Tell us more about those five domains again. Let's repeat those again and see what areas that people are manipulated within.
Well, media being the most obvious. Here, Canada, of course, was the Izzy Asper clan and the Black, Conrad Black and that crowd. Here it's the media dominance. All you need to do is turn on the news channels and look at the leadership within media. And if you go to pop culture, it's helpful, and particularly in film, if you want me to embrace a narrative, it helps if you can sort of pre-stage that narrative through numerous storylines that attract me into look at a screen and go, oh, that's very interesting. And then suddenly that storyline becomes a reality. And a quick story on that point. The fellow who's head of CBS and the fellow who's head of MCA, when CBS opened its office in New York, it began to feature what we called the top 40 songs. And he featured only MCA people that MCA had on retainer to do the performances. And so you were led to believe that that those songs were indeed the top 40. And you know what happened? If you believe they were the top 40, you went out and bought those songs. And then what happened? In fact,
they became the top 40. Exactly. Yep.
So a lot of this has to do with how you displace facts with what you can be induced to believe. And if you believe hard enough in something like the top 40, it becomes the top 40. If you believe that Israel is an ally, despite the facts, then they remain an ally. So part of this challenge has been to permeate that get in that in-between domain and say, look, here are the true facts. In politics, if you just go down the list of those who've now come to power and the key agenda-setting committees, you'll get an idea of what has been done. And that's not to say that these people are consciously complicit. It's that they themselves believe that they're doing the Lord's work, so to speak, by advancing an agenda that's consistent with the far right in Israel, that's inconsistent with our values, but we've been led to believe something very different. So you've got media, you've got pop culture, you've got politics, you've got think tanks, and this is a real nest bed of those complicit. There's a number of NGOs that have operated abroad, many of them going after regime change. The National Republican Institute, the International Republican Institute, chaired by John McCain, the National Democratic Institute, chaired by Madeleine Albright, the Open Society, of course, funded and run by George Soros. And if you go down the list of those that have been most worrisome to those whose governments have been upset by this, you found that common sort of pro-Israeli staffing throughout all of them. But here in the U.S., having worked in politics and as a counsel to a committee in the Senate for many years, many of the ideas that come into politics come from those think tanks. And so if you can begin to dominate that area, then that's very helpful. In education, I was educated in what's called the Chicago model. And anyone who's taken anything to do with economics, business, law, finance, accounting in the last 80 years has been educated in what's called the Chicago model. And that is now, it's also called the neoliberal model. It's now been embedded in law. It's been embedded in contract law, corporate law, property law. And I found it best expressed in working as counsel to an investment banking firm in New York, when our partner would come in, our managing partner, and say in the morning like a mantra, He say, money is smarter than people. Have we made any today? And that's the best summary I've yet to hear of a very, you know, intricate, complex sort of theory called the Chicago model, now called the Washington Consensus. And the notion is that money is smarter than people. Financial freedom has now become a proxy for personal freedom. And so it's instead of let my people go, it's now let my money go. Money's smarter than you. Do you have a Nobel Prize in economics? Well, no. Well, look at who all those Nobel Prizes in economics have been given to. Just go back and read them. I did. And you don't qualify unless you are an adherent and an advocate of this particular model. So you embed that mindset in any value that cannot be identified and captured in terms of money is by law now, and I helped write some of those laws, is by law displaced. And so the values like civil cohesion and fiscal foresight and environmental sustainability, if you were to ask people in communities what are the top values that they most want to see, those would be very near the top. But those values are displaced, and people have been induced to displace them freely. If one guy is offering a 4.2% return and someone else a 3.8% return, the person offering the 3.8% return better have a really strong story to tell me, because I'm going to go for the 4.2% return.
Right. Mm.
And so by the time you embed this fiction, in enough mindsets, then suddenly you've got this shared mindset that becomes a consensus. And then you embed that consensus in politics and media and education and whatnot. And suddenly worldwide, you've got the emergence of what we've now got, the greatest disparity in wealth and income we've had in history. Oligarchs emerging everywhere we look, including the United States. And now instead of the freedom of expression that now has the most power in politics is the freedom to make campaign contributions.
Right.
So now you have Shelley Adelson, a ultra right wing pro-Israeli American, pro-Likud supporter, very disappointed that the money he put into Mitt Romney's campaign did not get him into the White House so we could go to war with Iran.
But
he's likely to be back. He's quite likely to be back, he and his friends, with no limit on the amount of money that they can put in to buying a presidency and taking us to war in Iran. To take us to war in Iran, it required the killing of 3,000 Americans, or people, at least around the World Trade Center. But we don't need that this time. Now the playing field is set so that, in effect, the presidency can be purchased.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Several points that I wanted to ask you more about. Has there been any difference under Obama?
Well, I mean, you'll see in the book the description of what's called assets. Assets are people, to some extent, we're all assets based on our beliefs and our needs and interests and appetites and whatnot. But assets are people that have been profiled in sufficient depth, that personality profile, that if you've put them in a time, place, and circumstance over which you can have enormous amount of control, particularly in politics, then you know within an acceptable range of probabilities they will perform consistent with their profile. When you walked Monica Lewinsky in front of Bill Clinton, you knew within an acceptable range of profile of probabilities what the response is going to be. Okay? Now Barack Obama came to Chicago, spent 11 years at the University of Chicago teaching constitutional law. He was groomed by Betty Lou Saltzman, who's the daughter of Phil Klecznik, who was a UN ambassador back in the 70s, hugely pro-Israeli. I think initially he was an asset. I think my hope and every indication is that he woke up. He's obviously very smart, and he has a very stable situation around him, which helps. Clinton did not have that. LBJ, Kennedy, others did not have that with his wife and his children and whatnot. I think he woke up. And I think he realized that those who created his political career were attempting to use him. Now, I hope I'm not whistling past the graveyard on this, but we've clear indications, or at least what we hope were clear indications, that he is now waking up. Now, it's difficult to expose those who've done something like this when you yourself, if you yourself indeed are a product of those who've done this. That's very challenging. And because this is very nonlinear, how do you induce those who've done this to expose themselves. And if that is what is now going on, then I'm going to go, hooray. Let's hope that's the case. I'm frankly thrilled that Benjamin Netanyahu is going to come to Washington and try to sell us on the war in Iran, and helped in that by John Boehner and others in the leadership in the Congress. My hope is that the American public is going to wake up and say, oh, we get it. Yeah. You know, we're being sold another war, and who is doing the selling, and how did they come to office, and who supported their candidacies over the years? Who helped put them in powers of position and powers and in certain places of position and influence where we could now be sold on yet another war that is not in our interest?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, well, this may be very good news.
Yeah, that we can hope. I just fear that way too many people around in these environments of government are already staunch, you know, Zionist supporters. There might be Christian Zionists themselves, you know, and it feels like the whole, I mean, you told me about something, for example, when we talked a while back before this interview, about something like the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. I mean, I knew about AIPAC already, for example, that it's a very strong bond between America and Israel, but there's so many of these organizations that you have to be, you know, deeply, maybe not embedded is the right word, but you have to be well in with these organizations to attain any kind of level of power within the United States, correct?
Yeah, I think that is correct at this point. AIPAC, the one you mentioned, American-Israel Political Affairs Committee, is typically identified as the Israel lobby. That's a little bit of a misnomer. They're part of it, and they're hugely influential. However, they do not directly raise money. What they do is that they screen candidates, and then they go out and identify bundlers, people who put together money from other people and give it to a candidate, provided they don't have to be just pro-Israeli. They have to be pro-right-wing Israeli. Otherwise, you don't get their funding. The Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations has been around for a very long time. Frankly, considerably more powerful because they do raise money and they know everyone. They know the full network of those who will support this and have for many years. There's a story, and I forget whether I include it in the book or not. It's in a blog an op-ed somewhere. Jack Kennedy, during the last years of his months of his campaign, began to run low on cash, so he went up to see the conference. And I talked to a fellow who. Several people urged me to talk to this fellow named Charlie Bartlett, who introduced Jack to Jackie. And I interviewed Charlie because I had heard from two different people who said when Jack came back from that meeting, he was livid. And he called Charlie, and I think they drove up and down the Potomac or something. And I said, well, Charlie, what was going on? And he said he was just absolutely so angry. I never seen him like that. He said he went into this meeting and he said, well, I need some more money to finish out the campaign. They said, we know that. And he said, we'll give you all the money you need, provided you turn over Middle East policy to us. And apparently it was just as candid as that. And he was really upset. Now, I think that this crowd thought that being the son of Jack Kennedy, who was a major thug, son of Joe Kennedy, that they would that he would play along. And I think he did not play along. He clearly did not play along. He initially pressed the Ben-Gurion to confirm that they had a nuclear weapons development program, which they had, which he was going to shut down. Meanwhile, his brother Robert, as Attorney General, and Bill Fulbright, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, were working to force their lobby to register as what they were then and remain, which is foreign agents, unregistered foreign agents. Had those two initiatives succeeded, had Israel's nuclear weapons program been shut down, and had this lobby, it's now a vast lobby, had this lobby been required to register as foreign agents, we would live in a different country, and the people worldwide would live in a very different world. That's without a doubt. So we're still trying to make sure that can happen, and but it's going to take some doing. And I think we're within reach of being able to bring the registration component of that about. To even raise that again as a possibility, I think is now going to be. Is going to be a possibility with Netanyahu showing up in Washington to try to sell us on a war with Iran.
Yeah, exactly. I want to get a little bit more to that later. What would you say to those who believe that, you know, Israel is a big supporter of the United States, and kind of without the U.S., you know, they would fall, or I guess we can view it this way, that many in America might believe that, you know, they need to, as the slogan goes now, stand by Israel. Otherwise, you know, they are not dutiful and they wouldn't support democracy in the Middle East, etc. What would you say to those people?
I'm sorry, I was watching the TV screen. As you were speaking, it says Obama will not meet with Netanyahu during his visit. And he's using the excuse that he doesn't want to influence Israeli elections.
All right, well, that's interesting. We'll see how that pans out.
if Obama is on to this, what the Israeli right has done to us, then anyone who really gets this is going to be so outraged. It's going to be, the challenge is going to be to contain the outrage so that we really do go after those complicit, rather than those complicit trying to turn it into some anti-Semite thing and people saying it's the Jews doing this when it's not. So forgive me, let's roll back to your question again, but that was the news as we speak.
Okay, I might return to that later too, but okay, I was basically asking about what you would say to those people who believe that, you know, Israel, first of all, is a supporter of the United States, that is like, it's Israel and the U.S. together, and they need to, as the slogan goes now, stand by Israel. What would you say to those people, be they, you know, Christian Zionists, or be they just, you know, believers in, you know, in democracy and that Islam is the big enemy here?
This is a branding exercise. I mean, we saw it with Ariel Sharon when he said, you know, both he and Netanyahu said before 9/11, he said, well, you know, we stand shoulder to shoulder with America, and America will stand shoulder to shoulder with us once they understand the cost we paid for Islamic terrorism, and on a population weighted basis. In order for that to happen, Americans would need to lose about 5,000 people to terrorism, and that, remember, that was the initial body count of the attack of the World Trade Center. We thought it was about 5,000 people. Ended up being about 3,000 people. And then Netanyahu said, this is really, really quite good. And they said, well, I don't mean it's good. It's just sort of good for, you know, to understand. So now Americans will sympathize with what we've been putting up for so long with, without any indication of the agent provocateur operations they've been running for decades to upset every Muslim on the planet. But that's that shoulder to shoulder notion. You saw it again in the march and the unity rally in Paris, mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah,
and Netanyahu forced his way into that parade. François Hollande said, please don't come, because we don't want it to appear that, you know, the West is aligned with Jews against Muslims. And he came anyway. They put him in the second row. He forced his way to the front row. And then he marches triumphantly down the street, waving to the crowd. You know, this is how media and optics and perceptions are manipulated to make people think that you've got a, that you're allied with someone who's actually operating as an enemy within the country, undermining us on every front.
So isn't the word for that, what is it to say? Chutzpah, right? Well, he just pushes his way forward. And what I'm surprised by, though, is that no one, when are these leaders going to speak out about this this type of behavior by Netanyahu, right?
Well, it gets very lonely out there if you try to say anything about this. For one, you've got your perception already screened. In order to be a member of Congress at this point, you have to have kind of run the gauntlet and proven your bona fides as a Israeli supporter. And that included, I think, Obama initially, until he realized, I think, what was really going on. But then if you are willing to entertain the notion that this could really be a problem, then who do you talk to? You got your other members there who are going to say, hey, we got this guy's a problem. I'm not this guy's problem. Or are you going to convene a hearing on it? Are you going to go to CNN and tell Wolf Blitzer about it? I mean, you know, it's really quite a challenge. And so it really, I think, initially is going to have to emerge from the office that this crowd has targeted the most consistently over decades, which is Office of the Presidency. And that office has been thoroughly targeted and corrupted for a very long time. We've had numerous, you know, by the time you have a presidential field, that field has been framed and the candidates screened, well screened, you know, by those that we're talking about. So the notion that you've got I mean, Kennedy had his issues around sexuality. We know that I included a photograph of of Lyndon Johnson with Matilda Krim and Guilt by Association. And Matilda's husband, Arthur Krim, then head of United Artists, is always a Hollywood connection. He bought his wife a mansion next to LBJ's ranch. She starts up an affair with LBJ while her husband is head of the campaign finance committee for the Democratic Party. And on the night that the 67 war broke out, she is in the White House servicing our commander in chief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, what do you think the chances are that Wolf Blitzer is going to cover that story, is going to even mention it?
Right. Yeah.
You know, how many Americans know that? None. You know, when you get the consistency of this, and you know, who put Monica Lewinsky in Bill Clinton's office? I think I know because I knew the crowd, you know, but do you go there? And if you do, you sound like you're, you know, anti-Semite or something, and you're not. And what you're trying to do is explain a very sophisticated form of criminality. And happily, a lot of the support we've gotten for that book came from the broader Jewish community, people calling us and saying, thank you. Thank you for filling in the blanks. Thank you for doing this with the professionalism and the concern for our community that we can begin to, we ourselves can begin to get a handle on this and identify and hopefully indict, prosecute, and imprison or execute those who've been doing this.
Well, perhaps those people that feel that way and, you know, belong to the group should be more outspoken then. I mean, I know a few, but I can count them on one hand, from Gilad Atzmon to Israel Shamir, and there are a couple of others out there. But if this is something which is in their interests and they feel that their name is being misused, isn't that something which should be coming from this group then, right?
Well, we're looking to take that on with this, with these publishing projects, and saying, here's how it works. It's not accusatory. It's saying, look, here's how you have been manipulated. I challenge someone, one of your viewers, if someone can come up with a definition of what it is to be Jewish. Is it ethnicity? Is it race? Is it genetics? Is it, what is it? And likewise, the term Zionism, you know, what is that? You know, so the sort of notion of what it is that we're fighting, and we're trying to make this very generic and show the repetitive behavior patterns and how, and the sort of criminal behavior templates by which this works. You displace facts with manipulated beliefs. That's a classic one. You know, the five primary pieces of intelligence on which we relied to go to war in Iraq, none of them were true. Yet we were led to believe that all of them were true. How does that happen?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so once you can get people to see how this works and they begin to see it themselves, I think we have people in the Jewish community say, I'd love to help you, but gosh, you know, I don't know. I'm in this community myself, and I've got a legal law practice or an accounting practice or whatever it is. And I've got to, you know, be a little careful myself. So it's a challenge.
Well, I mean, it has to be something which is defined by the goals that is sought to be attained by this criminal network, correct? I mean, if it's a survival mechanism rooted in, you know, group evolutionary strategy, then it's one thing. If it's simply the expansion for Israel, then it's another. If it's money and power alone or something like that, then there is a third option, right? So it has to be rooted, defined by what is sought by the group, right?
Well, that's the sort of challenge of all this, because what you find is we call it the Washington consensus. A consensus is a shared mindset by which people agree to operate. The World Trade Organization, there's a consensus that governs how it operates. It really doesn't have a governing body in the sense of someone who can say, this is what we're going to do. It's a consensus that this is how the world should operate, because after all, money is smarter than people, and we should just lower trade barriers regardless of results and just know that money, being as brilliant as it is, will sort everything out. And so what you found with each round of investment and each new generation of technology that comes online, that you get what we've now got, which is the emergence of oligarchies. And it's a lot easier to have influence and control over a small group of people than over a large group of people.
Right. Yeah.
So was that the sort of goal of all this? If you state it as plainly as that, which we will frankly do in this next book, then again, you're subject to charge of a conspiracy theory.
Sure, sure.
But well, there's also an old saying in systems science. They have it as an acronym. They call it POSIWID. The purpose of a system is what it does. P Posited. You know, this is what the system does. If that's not its purpose, why do we keep embracing it?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the issues here as well is we do have an emergence of a new media, which is great. And then, of course, I think we shouldn't get stuck in backpedaling or trying to defend ourselves from these accusations, because it turns into these kind of, you know, when did you stop beating your wife kind of analogies, right? Whatever you answer, it's you're in the trap, right? So it's like, you know, we have to just develop some tough skin here and just realize that, you know, this is too important to be smeared by a couple of words, which they have managed to get a tremendous amount of negative connotation around, and just kind of steamroll ahead and move forward, right? Because if we allow ourselves to be shut down by this type level of critique, which obviously is a tool in their arsenal to make sure that no people look in that direction, then we're going to be losing out, right?
Well, this is a manipulation of faith and a manipulation of belief. And we've got extremists in all of the major faith communities. We have Buddhists now killing each other over in Burma. I mean, it's quite bizarre. This particular faith tradition is extremely old. It predates there are three religions of the book, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And the two more modern versions are now been set at war against each other, or at least someone's trying to set us at war against each other.
Yeah.
And a colleague coined a very interesting phrase, I think is useful. He calls it the spatial void. What you have, and if you go to the religions like Hinduism and Buddhism and whatnot, you think of yourself as sort of being skin encapsulated consciousness. You know, the religions of the book say that what their real authority is outside of me. And what I need to do is turn to this book, and I will find the authority in this book. And then between you and the book, you place the mullah or the priest or the rabbi, and that becomes an ongoing source of manipulation. And it's that manipulation within that what he calls a spatial void that is very challenging for people to get, because they've been raised that way. They say, well, the priest or the mullah or whatnot has got my real interest at heart, and the priest, the true believers in that in-between space, like a rabbi or the mullah or the priest, may indeed be true believers and think they have your interest at heart. But that's very easy to manipulate, that space. And it's been manipulated for ages. And for us to even discuss this, Henrik, makes us heretics, you understand.
Yeah.
And so you no longer burn people at the stake, and you no longer can shoot the messenger. What you do is you use media to discredit them.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right.
And that's how that, so you do need, you, I don't think you need a tough skin. Well, you do need a little bit of a tough skin, but you need to have some confidence in your facts. And what you find is people who don't really have really fact-based sort of notions, they tend to get quite worked up defending their position, which is often their brand. And that's the reason I use the term conspiracy theorist, because a lot of these people do have brands, and they're going to defend that theory about how they think something happened, no matter what the facts are. And that usually is how you can spot them and expose them as well.
Let's talk for a moment here about how a war with Iran would look like, because I think we've had the strategic toppling of various leaders and countries in the Middle East have kind of changed a bit since Iraq and Afghanistan, which was one method of doing it. I think what we've seen now in Libya and Egypt, and of course, which has now kind of spiraled out of control a bit in Syria and Iran too, is that, the groups that we're talking about is basically largely through the West and NATO, et cetera, kind of funding various revolutionary groups. This is basically how Al-Qaeda arose with the war between Afghanistan and Russia. We now have ISIS and these organizations, whoever might be at the top of that, controlling them, that could be debated, but they're kind of running amok. But point being, they're being sponsored by the West in an effort to try to detopple them, and it did work in a country like Libya. So, what nature do you think a conflict with Iran would do? Would they do the same thing? We kind of saw, Twitter and the social media being part of this, of bringing out people onto the squares of the capitals in the city and demanding these leaders to step down, etc. Is that the nature of a war with Iran?
Well, let's hope we don't come to that. I mean, in truth, we've sort of been at war with Iran for at least in '79. With the so-called revolution there. But keep in mind, if you back up a little further, when George Herbert Walker Bush was the was the CIA director. He fired the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence, as our source of intelligence in the region, including our intelligence in Iran, because he found, as with everything that we found coming out of Tel Aviv for the most part, they were lying to us. They were putting their interest ahead of ours, which is to be expected if you're, you know, if you're an intelligence agency for a particular nation state. I would want my CIA to put my interest ahead of Israel. At the same time, that's the problem here, because this entangled alliance that we have, and we were urged not to do this, dating back to George Washington, said, do not do this. And we did it anyway. That we've had people manipulate our intelligence to take us to war. Now, what that would look like, I mean, we worked with the Israelis on the cyber warfare that helped, the Stuxnet virus that helped, run those centrifuges too fast where they burned out in Iran's facility. Yeah. That, if that isn't waging war, I don't know what is.
Yeah, that's right.
So we've been at war with Iran. The question is, cui bono, who really benefits if we go to war with Iran? And it's not clear that it's us, meaning the United States and Americans. It is very clear that the war in Iraq, the greatest beneficiary of it was those who took us to war in Iraq. And you don't have to dig very deep to find who that was and who cooked the intelligence and who brought Ahmad Chalabi over here from the Iraqi fellow who provided all that false intelligence, or who featured him, Judith Miller, on the front page of the New York Times to sell us that narrative. So I'm confident enough in the facts that can now be mustered that I think this next war can be short-circuited. I hope facts don't make a liar of me. The war with Iran is ongoing. I mean, what we usually think of as a war is when we send cruise missiles in to hit a facility, or when we take some bunker buster bombs and drop them on one of their nuclear sites, which is too deep to be impacted by it. But that's a population of 80 million people. We will further outrage the entirety of the Muslim world, well, at least the Shia portion of the Muslim world. And this war will metastasize into something else. So yeah. Here's hoping if those doing this cannot persuade us to take on this next war, we will get enough stability, I hope, that we will uncover who has done all of this. You have to keep this ongoing turmoil and keep the eye off the ball in order not to have this investigated. And with Bibi Netanyahu coming to town to sell us on the war along with John Boehner, I mean, what could be better than that? So let's hope that's what it takes to wake us up.
Now, do you take the view that a lot of these so-called terrorist acts that have occurred, Paris included, actually might have some links to various intelligence services, that these are false flag attacks in order to justify the continuation of the conflict that we now see? Because obviously we see, and even if that's not the case or not, we definitely could see who's trying to use the situation in that capacity. But I wouldn't put it past them with the history of, Gladio and other things like that, especially within in Europe.
Well, the attacks on Charlie Hebdo, I mean, the best commentary I saw on it was two fellows. One of them said that if that editor was not such a narcissist, he'd still be alive. The other one said if he weren't such a blockhead, he wouldn't have attracted the violence that killed him and his colleagues. I would take it beyond that. Charlie Hebdo published the same cartoons that set off the cartoon crisis in 2006 when its Danish counterpart, again run by this Jewish fellow, and forgive me, that's just the fact of the matter.
You don't have to apologize for that. That's reality. But, yeah.
Published cartoons with Muhammad with a bomb for turban, all that sort of thing. Now, it's all very cute, and I'm sure, French culture likes this kind of stuff. But the notion of free speech and whatnot came with also the notion you'd have some discretion. You don't yell fire in a movie theater, And so the extent to which they'd already been firebombed once, they had guards around them, they had a credible, threats beforehand. So once that happened, and I think this goes to the second part of your piece, once these people were attacked by these Islamic terrorists, then then yes, it definitely was used to advance an agenda. It wasn't a terrorist attack. It was an anti-Semite attack. It was let's dispatch 10,000 French troops to guard synagogues and Jewish schools. Let's hype this this notion that it's really an attack on civilization. I mean, I don't know if you recall, but in order to brand the Taliban, in March of 2001, there was an attack on the Buddhas at Bamiyan. These are these ancient Buddhas on the Silk Road and outside of Kabul. And it was telling that they were there when that no one really, I knew who the Taliban was, you probably did, but people who don't pay much attention to these things had no idea who they were. Suddenly you had an evildoer. You had a credible evildoer that done this awful thing. But it was telling to me that it was described in the American press as a cultural Holocaust. Okay. So you suddenly had this branding of this evildoers who in fact came online 6 months later and you know, there we are. So you've got, I think, again, an attempt to take an incident that was, you know, foreseeable as anything, and turning it to advance this narrative. Now we'll find out in time whether indeed it was some kind of a false flag. Who knows? But it's interesting that one of the two fellows was at one time a roommate of the underwear bomber. So-called underwear on Christmas Day, 2000, whatever it was. A Nigerian who managed to walk through security at Schiphol with no passport, having just bought a ticket for cash that had an incomprehensible flight plan to get him to where he wanted to go, bearing directly. And he was walked through. And then you look into that, and I'm sure you've talked with people on your show who've covered this, and you look at the people who handled security for that for Schiphol. Were an Israeli firm that was the same firm that had co-responsibility for the security at Logan Airport in Boston for 9/11. So I don't want to go there. I think that's all very interesting detail, and there are plenty of people digging into that who will, you know, in time that will all come to, you know, to be whatever it is, and whether that's, you know, correlation or causation, we'll find in time. I think what's more important is to keep your eye on the ball, which is how this works in plain sight by having you buy into a narrative and then take on an agenda that's really not in your long-term interest. And that's very much back in play right now.
Well, exactly. It has already been detrimental to the U.S. and to have all these different countries being at war with each other. It kind of goes back to the clash of civilization, et cetera, these kinds of ideas. But how, if we just talk a little bit about how do you see that this should be fought? What are some of the prime objectives here in order to begin to expose what's going on and get people, you know, away from the regular media programming, all these other things we were talking about? I've been talking quite a bit actually about pop culture as well now and talking about how important it is to have some kind of alternative to these things, because it's on this level where a lot of young people are completely dragged into their program, but a lot of things are on the TV and entertainment, music videos, all these kinds of things. It's very important to have instead our own stories being told as opposed to someone else's. But how do you view combating this and bringing attention to these issues we've been talking about?
Well, I mean, I must tell you, our confidence level just could not be any higher. And one reason for that is because of the ongoing financial stalking that we've undergone and continue to undergo. Because with the resources, we could have taken this sort of black ink on white pages into videos and cartoon strips and the kind of media that is more accessible to more people. Black ink on white pages is not it's an essential way to tell a story. It's not sufficient. You need to have character development. You need to have a narrative arc. You need to have writers, screenplay writers. You need to have people telling these accounts in ways that are accessible, entertaining, but remain factual. In time, you can take this off into fiction, and you know there'll be lots of sort of stories once people get how this operates, and you know Hollywood will have a ball with this. But I think you need more robust media. I mean, people listening to your show will help if people really get turned on to this, or if they read Guilt by Association or go online and do a search for, you know, my name and maybe Israel or something. You'll probably get a number of blogs, and you know, contact you and say, how can I help? You know, this needs help. This needs resources to get the talent behind this I mean, there's an old saying that best story wins. And these, the people being profiled are master myth makers and sophisticated storytellers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you concentrate on dominating that in-between space, then you've dominated the story. And the story is fundamentally a tragedy. It's particularly a tragedy for the broader Jewish community. So I'm hoping people in that community also will rally and say, what can we do? Well, we need some resources to hire the people to go, you know, deploy the talents that we don't have.
Right, right. Now, you said that Hollywood will have a ball with this. I doubt that because I see Hollywood as an extension to the very problem we've been talking about as it stands right now, in a way, because we have, it's very limited, it's very restricted in terms of the things that it talks about, in the same way that the news media is restricted. That's what I feel, in a way. So I don't see any hope coming from that particular angle. I think what we need is it's alternative to Hollywood. I don't say we have to reinvent the wheel necessarily, but more people need to take their talents and things elsewhere. I think there should be more independence now with the internet. Even distribution in itself is so much simpler these days than it was just 20 years ago, right? So there should be something here, TV channel online or something like that, which is entertaining and of fairly high production value, etc. It should be able to be pulled off, right?
Well, this works through what's called fractals and aggregates. You have the fractals are the, kind of those five domains I mentioned, for example, the media, pop culture, and whatnot. And so, what happens with the ongoing storyline and all those fractal areas is it aggregates in your mind as a plausible and even a desirable agenda, such as going to war in Iraq. So I think the counter to this is also going to be done on a fractal basis. You're going to have, people in academia who are going to begin to replace the consensus model and show it's problematic. The people in media are beginning to, you begin to get some internet media and begin to get some cinema on the internet as well. But I think, you don't want to have to rebuild bricks and mortar to educate people. You want to go into schools and say, look, your curriculum is off base. You don't need to rebuild the Hollywood studios. You need to find writers and filmmakers, and there's some great ones out there, and some who are beginning to realize what they've been complicit in without knowing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And say, hey, look, we've got a whole new Hollywood that can be built around, things that are aspirational and positive and optimistic and at the same time expose how we took a path that has taken us into war. And I think the documentaries that will aggregate around this work in time will help enormously. But again, that's going to take resources to do that. Yes, Hollywood has definitely been a problem, no doubt about it. And we'll do a book just on that in time. We'll hopefully maybe do some films on it and just show how you embed these storylines. But that'll all be done in time, and it's going to take resources and more people than we can currently afford to bring on board.
Yes, indeed. Now, the book is called Guilt by Association, How Deceit and Self-Deceit Took America to War. And of course, as you mentioned, this is kind of the first book in a series here. So what are the estimated times here on the follow-up book, Jeff?
Well, we anticipate the next book will be out mid-2015, maybe it might be early 2016. But the notion is to have it in place in time to influence the 2016, quote, election, end quote. And that's why we hope to get in place early enough, perhaps to have some influence on the nominating conventions. But that's already well along, and the candidates are now emerging we know are problematic. But that, again, it doesn't mean that people who are problematic cannot wake up. And, to some extent, we're all assets of this phenomenon. Certainly I was. I was a true believer in the Chicago model. I helped enable this as a Senate Finance Committee counsel for 7 years, drafting a law that helped amass, it's now about $12 trillion in hands of money managers. So I helped enable that model. To the extent to which people can wake up and realize there's another way we can go, and on the back end of this is a new kind of way of doing business that we're also launching on a parallel path that will in time begin to displace the current model. But that's for a discussion for another time. But there's an old saying, and again, in system science, you can't solve a problem until you know what the problem is.
And, yeah, that's right.
So that's the immediate issue is to make sure people realize there is a problem and here's its common source, and quit pretending it's otherwise, and don't be intimidated by those who want to shut you up with a smokescreen that they've used on others, because this is too serious. Just gauge the facts, but stay closely within the facts of what can be proven, and don't stray outside that. And many people do. If that is done, I'm confident we can solve this problem.
All right, very good. Now, of course, people can, as you said, Google your name, Jeff Gates, and Israel or Zionism, and find a lot of articles written. I don't know if you have any specific websites you'd like to plug, but please let us know where people can go to pick up copies of your book, Jeff.
Yeah, well, we had a website called Criminal State, which was disappeared. So that's no longer there. There was a ability to order books there, which is no longer there as well. But you can get them off the usual online ordering sites for books. So please do that, and let people know that this is out there. When we publish this book, and keep in mind it came out before the 2008 election, so but we rushed it into print because we wanted it in circulation, because we knew we'd get no distribution, we knew we'd get absolutely no marketing or reviews because of the people in between, we also knew we would have an "I told you so" book, and that's what this is. But it really, its purpose is to give the reader the tools to see this deceit for themselves. And keep in mind, the second part of the title is also hugely important. It's how deception and self-deceit took us to war. The first part is easy, and I'm sure you've had a lot of people talking about that. But the self-deceit portion is far more sinister and often much more difficult for people to grasp.
Yeah, yeah.
But the book provides the tools where people can begin to look in the mirror and say, "Oh my God, am I unconsciously part of this due to my own beliefs?" And the short answer is yes.
Thank you for coming on, Mr. Gates. Great having you today. Thank you so much for doing it. And maybe we can have you back again in the future and do a second hour when you're not so busy. But for now, we say keep up the good work. Glad to have you here.
Great to be here, Henrik. Thank you.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening today. We hope you've learned something new, a very important topic to grasp to understand American foreign policy, why America is at war, and why the wars in the Middle East just keeps continuing and growing. Another side effect of this is also the chaotic migrations into Europe and other Western countries. And for some curious reason, not many North African or Arab countries are accepting these refugees for some reason. Very curious. But so this is really a domino of havoc that this has created, and it needs to be shut down at the root, at the source. We'd like to say thanks to Christopher Bolin as well for helping us to get in contact with Jeff Gates and recommending him as a guest. So thanks, Chris. We have a lot more to cover, of course, in these areas. I also recommend that you check out our archives for more on these questions. We have quite a bit there already on all of this. We do 3 new programs per week. We usually do 2 hours each show. Not always, though, due to the time restraints of some of our guests, like Jeff today. But the first hour of our program is always free. Sometimes we have both for free. Our programs are available for stream or download at redicecreations.com, our main website. We spare you from commercial interruptions and blinking website banners, but we have a members website where we have both hours of all our programs available, the full show. And our archive goes back to 2006 on a lot of topics that we find to be the most interesting and important. So check it out, redicemembers.com. If you like what we do, if you care about these important topics and our future and want to hear more, please go there to sign up and tune in. We have more coming up, folks. Monday, we have Chris Fogarty on the Irish Holocaust, an unknown aspect of history that is never recognized or talked about. We have British academic Nick Kellerstrom, a renegade who became a truth seeker and ended up writing a book called Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth and Reality. Very controversial, very interesting. A scholar who's brave enough to ask questions that few others dare to ask. We have Mike King on his book, The Bad War. We have John Friend from The Realist Report. Also John Rappaport on the continuation of the vaccine scandal that's continuing to unfurl at this moment. We have Sally Fallon from the Weston Price Foundation and many more coming on after this. My thanks to the Red Ice team and again to you for listening and for caring. But please join us at redicemembers.com for more. We'll talk to you again in just a few days. Have a good weekend, everyone.